Ho, 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 hello, and welcome back to Bah Humbug 2023. We're here again. It's the Christmas Movies podcast that reckons that all the best Christmas toys are made entirely from plywood. Hi, everybody. My name is Helen O'Hara. I'm going to be your host once again. And today I am delighted to be talking about Santa Claus the Movie, a film that's very close to my heart because basically it apparently restored my faith in Santa Claus for a good number of years, just when it was teetering on the brink as a young child. And my dad tells me that this absolutely put all doubts out of my head for years after seeing it. I'm not sure what that says about me as a young person, but here we are talking about Christmas movies X number of years later, so it says something. But yes, this is of course the Alexander Sulkin produced giant epic Santa Claus the Movie, a film that was, alas, a famous flop, but not in the UK, where it was shot and where it made something like 5 million at the box office, which is no mean feat for the mid-1980s. And joining me to discuss it is someone who is even bigger of a fan than I am. Please welcome comedian and writer, author, Mark Burrows, who you're quite into this, aren't you?
Santa Claus the Movie was the first film I ever saw at the cinema.
Really? Oh. So set the scene for me. How old were you?
So it was 84, 85, right?
In the 85, in the, I believe, yeah.
So I would have been 4 years old. Oh. So it was the first time it was like, you know, bundled up, taken to Hinckley Curzon Cinema, which was a tiny cinema in the rubbish town near where I grew up. And I remember it really vividly. But it's one of those things where I remember the magic on the screen, because the way that film opens, the snow and the twinkliness, the sheer twinkliness of that opening.
So many twinkles.
But I also remember being obsessed with I've just very accurately told you how old I am, but what this tells you about how different that was. I remember being slightly obsessed with the cigarette smoke in the projecting beam, and being almost as mesmerized by that as I was by jolly old Saint Nick on the screen. And it was just like a really formative thing for me. And that film burned itself into my kind of hard-coded sub level in a way that almost no other film has. Mm-hmm. And I've watched it every year because it's on every year, mm-hmm, extremely reliably. And I know it backwards. I honestly do. It's difficult to say I'm a fan of it. Like, I'm not a fan of it in the way that I'm a fan of, like, you know, the movies that create your fandom personality or bands I like or anything like that. And, you know, no one's putting the poster of this on their wall. No one's writing their thesis on it. But it's really important to me.
So it's more like, it's more oxygen than a movie you choose to like. It's just a movie that has to be there. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly, yeah. It's just that, and it's always been there. And I think about it weirdly often. You know, when like every time I get in a really comfy bed, I think about, Mrs. Claus, aka Daisy from Keeping Up Appearances, going, I don't want to go to sleep because this mattress is so comfortable, I don't want to miss a moment of it. Mm. And like little things like that pop into my head all the time.
At the risk of also aging myself quite precisely, I did a bit of research on the film today. I was looking up some of the stats, some of the people involved and so on, and I realised I'm the same age as Mrs. Claus. And I'm not okay. I don't feel old enough to be married to Santa. I'm just going to say it. I just don't feel like I'm there yet.
But they aged them up a bit. They aged them up a little bit, didn't they? How old was David Huddleston when he did it?
He was 55. So that's okay. We're not there yet. We're okay.
But classic trope, throw in a younger woman and the older man.
I know. But yeah, she was probably, I guess, 44 when they filmed it. And look, she looks great, actually.
She
looks
look
really
great.
Charming. She's, you know, they haven't massively aged her up. They've just given her slightly old-fashioned hairdo. But it has scarred me. It has really worried me, and I needed to take a moment after discovering that. So it was the first moments. It's the sort of, what, you know, toy maker coming into the small village kind of scenes immediately got you on board.
Yeah, that whole opening sequence of the... But it's not... Because that's not the bit you remember. Mm. When you go back, you don't remember the toy maker and the the little children and the wood carvings and the old lady telling her story and all that bit at the beginning. What you remember is when they freeze to death almost. And I'm still not sure if they do freeze to death.
I feel like they might. I mean, I'm really confused because they don't at any point say, oh, you died. They say, oh, you're going to live forever. But I feel like it's very heavily implied that they died, right?
I was thinking when I rewatched it today, and I've had this thought before. But it's that bit and the bit that happens next when the heavens literally open, and Dudley Moore marches out in a little suit, and it's just brilliant. And it's like that's and the. Although I do always remember them talking, the old lady when she tells a story, talking about all the colours of the rainbow and some that haven't been invented yet or something like that. And that always struck me as a really evocative line and going, oh,
it's a great line, but they only have the primary colours, actually. So, come on, lady.
But yeah, well, I figured that maybe the camera wasn't sophisticated enough to capture like those kind of colours yet. But yeah, it's that opening of the beam of light and it's splitting apart and the elves coming out with their torches and then the house, the incredible giant sort of not quite a castle, not quite a house, basically a factory. Lot of pine. So much pine.
So much.
There's so much great wood, great carving in there. And like that whole opening sequence, that whole opening, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes is completely magical. Like it's really, really, that's Christmas for me. That is the whole of Christmas for me.
I think also that this is a lot of what put my mind to rest about the whole Santa thing is that all seemed to make sense to me. It's like, okay, so a hole opens in the sky and then you go through to the Santa North Pole as opposed to the boring one that all those nature documentaries go to. Okay, that makes total sense. And he, how does he get up and down the chimney when there clearly isn't enough room for a grown person to get up and down my chimney? Well, he just sort of blinks and... Oh, okay. Why did no one tell me this before? That makes total sense. I don't know what it says about me that all made more sense to me than, you know, my teetering faith in Santa before this.
What I quite like about it and what I think it must have been the intention of it is to explain those things.
Yes.
Let's give a credible mythology. Let's do a credible origins. Let's do a Santa origin story. This is where he comes from. This is how he gets his special powers. This is the bit where he's literally made a saint by a weird old man who lives there and he's only ever seen once and we never see him again, but it's an amazing performance.
Burgess Meredith.
By the Penguin. It's the Penguin from the 60s Batman. Amazing. Who I was always baffled. Where does he go? He comes out of nowhere, like with his big Gandalf beard, being supported by the elves, other elves around him, and then he blesses Santa and his wife and says he's now going to be Santa Claus. He makes him a saint. Like he blesses him, says he'll live forever, says that time will travel with him, and then he's never seen again. And it's completely baffling. Like where does that guy go?
Hey, What's his deal? If he's making people a saint, presumably he goes back to the Vatican? I don't know. I mean, there must be something like that.
Well, I was thinking elves, long white beard. No, he passes over the sea. That's
of
where
course.
He goes.
He goes into the West and diminishes and does not remain Galadriel.
No. But although I once did, years ago, I did a gig with a band I was in, and somebody put on our Facebook, one of my band thought it'd be really funny to put on our Facebook page that if it gets so many likes, this post gets so many likes, I would do my, like I was doing a solo set as the opening act of Christmas songs I'd written. I'm really into Christmas. And if they got enough likes, I would dress as an elf to do it. This was without my consent. And it did obviously get the requisite number of likes. So I got somebody to make me like a battle elf costume. A Lord of the Rings elf, and I did it like that because that's how cool I am.
I like it. I feel like we should have more crossover between battle elves and Santa Claus elves. I feel like that would really pep up some of the... And I know some of these Christmas movies have attempted to do something along those lines. You know, the little Disney ones where the elves are almost like a SWAT team. Kinda.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and there's Arthur Christmas, which does
Arthur Christmas
a little bit
as well. Yeah, but really, I want full Battle Elf. I want more like Rise of the Guardians, but not set at Easter. A reminder that is not a Christmas film; it is an Easter film. This is the hill I will die on. Anyway,
I want Hugo Weaving and Kate Blanchett just making wooden toys. That's what I want from my Santa Claus film.
Can we talk about the toys? Because this was actually something that, again, like yourself, I think, I remember being enchanted by the workshop and thinking, oh my, well, this all makes sense. I mean, admittedly, okay, I don't see the place where they make the Barbies and the Cindys and the Care Bears, which was very big for me at the time in the 80s. But presumably that's a different room. But this looks like Santa's workshop to me. This makes sense. That said, every review at the time seems to have picked up on the fact that it's just making rubbish wooden toys and there isn't a single My Little Pony in sight and it all looks a bit cheap, maybe, now.
It does all look a little bit cheap. I mean, no, it looks hand-carved and wholesome.
Wholesome, maybe that's the word.
And also, the first half of that film is set... I mean, I tried to work out the date when I was watching it earlier because the first time we're told a date, it's the 14th century, mm-hmm. I think. So presumably we're looking at it's the Dark Ages. It's somewhere around there. So I mean, wooden trucks and little like whittled models of Dudley Moore would be perfectly good presents for children back then. They're just happy that they got given anything that
and
wasn't
just
smallpox.
The Black Death.
Yeah, exactly. So actually, I think, like, you know, presumably later on he does learn to make Optimus Prime, but. But you're right, I mean, there is a whole thing with Santa, with Santa movies, because there's only four kinds of Christmas movies. I was thinking about this earlier on. There's only four kinds of Christmas movies. There's Baby Jesus movies, there's Scrooge movies, there's Hallmark Lady Goes Home movies, and there's Santa movies. That's it. And if you're looking at the Santa movies, you have to make a mental adjustment that you can't get over, which is that Santa exists in that world and is real and people know about it. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise you're never going to, like, the logic just doesn't work. People know about it because some presents appear under the tree every year. There's no explanation other than that. When people say they don't believe in Santa, you go, well, that doesn't quite work because you must know that people get presents out of nowhere. He's just an old fraud. So you kind of have to accept that. So I kind of think in this universe, he makes the nice, wholesome, hand-carved or elf-made or machine or poorly machined version of those presents. And then your mum gets you Optimus Prime. That's how
right.
I think about
that
it.
That makes sense. Yeah, because Elf went the other way. Elf has them literally making, you know, the etch-a-sketches and things. But I think that's probably correct in this case. And look, it does look magical. The other thing that I always remember loving is the reindeer.
Yeah, and it's actually a really nice mix of animatronic and real.
Yeah.
Like, when you're looking at it, like, and you can't always they blur it quite well. You can't always tell. There's a few bits where you're like, oh, puppet, definitely.
Yeah.
But mostly, like, those animatronics are good. Mm-hmm. You know, that is good, solid, in-camera special effects. That is people in costumes. That is creature workshops. Like, that, and they work, and they're adorable. Those little kind of asides that they do, when there's a bit where he wants to do the loop-the-loop thing and one of the reindeers at the front tries to look away and can't do it, and it's really, like, really well characterized. Like,
great reindeer
work.
Side eye, really, isn't it? Yeah.
Absolutely. And I can't think of another film that has good reindeer side eye.
You don't get it enough. I mean, I do think, all right, now I'm, you know, occasionally on this podcast I will nitpick films I nevertheless love. Let me suggest to you a nitpick. The loop-the-loop thing. It, you know, it makes no sense. First of all, you've got a bag full of toys in the back of the sleigh. What are you doing looping anything? Second of all, in what way is that actually helpful at the end in a way that, for example, just flying under the exploding sled would not be? I would question Santa's methodology.
No, I absolutely had that thought earlier on as well. And it has occurred to me before when watching that film that there's only one way we're going to save them from falling out of that exploding car. Really, what is it? We're going to fly underneath them, carry on. Mm-hmm. Then we're going to go up into the sky, do a loop-de-loop, and then we'll catch them. Well, it's just showing off, really, isn't it? There's no There's absolutely no need. Also, that car explodes. There's no way that those two people survive.
Like, yeah, it's weird. It's almost like they're on a projector seat, right? Or ejector seat, I should say. So they get ejected straight upwards, the two of them, mm-hmm. while then the car explodes just below them, and then they drop through the space cleared, I guess, by the explosion. I'm not a physics expert.
No.
But I it did slightly trip my bullshit-ometer.
Well, this is also a film that ends with John Lithgow, like, drifting off into space, apparently still able to breathe and shout. So, you know, there's only so much I think we can really pull it apart.
That was quite haunting to me as a kid. I was like, whoa, can that happen?
And apparently, yeah, again, apparently. I know. I remember thinking the same thing, but also thoroughly deserved.
I mean, he's a bad'un. He is a bad'un. But yeah, let's talk about the effects for a minute, because I also watched the making of documentary on this, which I've been meaning to watch for a while since I interviewed the person who directed it. Have you ever noticed who directed the making of documentary about Santa Claus the movie?
Who did it?
I could give you 1,000 guesses and you would not name the person, okay?
Is it Nicholas Lyndhurst?
It's, I think, weirder than that. At least it is. Okay, I'm just going to tell you, it is Danny Houston.
What?
Danny Houston, as a very young man, directed the making of documentary for Santa Claus the movie. And they've done it. It's a thorough making of documentary. So they get into, you know, the visual effects and the special effects. They talk about the reindeer and the animatronic reindeer. They talk about the casting choices and putting the story together. And David Huddleston stays in character as Santa throughout the entire thing. Because, of course, that's correct. He is actual Santa. Kids, don't worry.
I watched the first 15 minutes and I did enjoy David Huddleston in character. And even to the point of Dudley Moore saying, well, you know, they ran me up to say, do you want to be in the film? And I thought, well, I'm a bit too young to play Santa. No, I don't look like Santa. No, we want you to be an elf. Santa's playing himself.
I mean,
of course. David Huddleston is Santa. He's so perfect. Like, you can pick a lot apart with this film, but you can't pick apart Huddleston's performance. He is so good in it. Like, that moment, the moment with the cookie, the moment where he first meets the little girl and she goes, do you want a cookie? They're from Bloomingdale's. And he picks one up and goes, oh, chocolate chip, my favourite. And he just seems so excited and genuinely delighted to have a cookie. And he totally sells it. He totally sells a role that should not be possible to sell. But yeah, that the Danny Houston thing's incredible. But then this film is a weird sort of centre of stuff. Like, there are so many people involved in this film, and you go, what? I mean, Henry Mancini does the score. The lyrics are written by the person who wrote Goldfinger.
Yeah, Leslie Bricusse, right?
To music by the person who wrote Moon River.
I know.
Like, it's... there's so much stuff this with that, and you look at the bit, like, it's got Mike from The Young Ones in it as an elf. It interlinks in so many different ways. I don't like Daisy from Keeping Up Appearances is married to the Big Lebowski. It's just brilliant.
Wait, was he the Big Lebowski?
Yeah, David Huddleston was Lebowski.
Sorry, yes, I'm just having a complete brain meltdown. Of course he was. Anyway, but yeah, it all goes back to the Sulkins, doesn't it? It goes back to the producer, Alexander Sulkind, who by this point was working with his son, Ilya Sulkind, and they just didn't spare any expense. They got the biggest people. What is fascinating to me as well is the people they originally went to make the movie. So if your mind was blown by Danny Houston, famed Hollywood bad guy, directing the making of... Spare a thought for the lost possibility of John Carpenter directing Santa Claus the movie with Brian Dennehy starring as the big man himself. That's trippy.
Not only did they want John Carpenter, but John Carpenter only said he'd do it if he could do the score as well. And John Carpenter's Santa Claus the movie with da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da as the score. It changes the tone dramatically, but I am... Like, you know how there's two versions of Legend, where you can either have the version with the Ridley Scott's Legend, where you have the version with the orchestral score, or the version with the Tangerine Dream score. Like, can we get Carpenter to score Santa Claus the Movie? Like, he's still around. He's still doing it. He's still doing music. He did the music for the Halloween requels. It's possible. He can do it. I would really love to see it. But did you see who sings the opening number?
Is that Sheila Easton?
No, Sheila Easton sings the closing one. Do you know who? You know, it opens with a choir boy singing, "Every Christmas Eve, we are part of a miracle." Mm-hmm. If you had to say, this is the opposite of what you said. Like, if you had a million guesses, you'll get it on the first one.
Is it Alla Jones?
It's Alla Jones. It's actually Alla Jones, who didn't sing on the original version of the on the TV version of The Snowman, but does sing the opening to Santa Claus the Movie. Like, it's perfect.
So that is that's a great pub quiz fact. Just anybody listening out there, if you're ever going to any kind of Christmas themed pub quiz, Alla Jones did not sing the original version of Walking in the Air, but did sing the opening song to this.
I had this exact thought earlier on, which is that it's a brilliant multiple choice pub quiz question.
100%.
Which of these movies did Alla Jones sing the main Christmas song to? Was it A, The Snowman, B, Santa Claus the Movie, C, I don't know, Elf?
That would be evil, and I love it.
Yes. But yeah, the people involved with this are amazing. It's full of brilliant British character actors who are always on. If you watch the elves, like any scene with the elves, watch the background, because actually we've both seen the new restored Blu-ray that they've just put out, and I was of the opinion that it didn't really matter. I could have just watched it on Now TV or something and I'm sure it would have been the same, but I watched the Blu-ray and actually it is beautifully presented and you can make out a lot more. And if you watch, keep your eye on the elves in the background, like keep your eye on Christopher Ryan, who was Mike in The Young Ones, and one of two actors in it who played Sontarans in Doctor Who, and every time he's on screen, he's always doing something. He's always like that. Like, he's always acting his socks off in these tiny roles in the background of diminutive British character actors. And it's like they're really going for it. Everything about this film works. There's a real authenticity to everything. They really try hard. That mythology, like, they really try hard to put it in place. The set is amazing. Like, that set is wonderful. And they must have spent they must have been so much detail in that set and so many you can tell there's layers and levels and things you can climb over and stuff like that. And there's loads of craftsmanship in it. I've got to watch the rest of the making of, because I did want to look, because I was watching thinking the flying stuff really works. I mean, I know this is producers who have a lot of experience of making things fly on screen.
Yes, because for anyone who doesn't know, the Sulkins made the Superman movies. So,
and the same director, whose name I cannot pronounce.
I think I want to say Schwarz. I don't know.
Is it Schwarz? Jeanette Schwarz. But he did Supergirl, which is also a film that I really, really love from that era. And I haven't watched since probably the early 90s, because I don't want to be disappointed by how bad it is. Because I'm very fond of Supergirl. Which actually means, consecutively, he worked, thinking about it, with Peter Cook and then Dudley Moore, which is brilliant. But yeah, he's working really, really hard to make everything, you know, work brilliantly. The flying scenes do really work. Like when you see the sleigh taking off and landing in the New York rooftops, it looks good. It holds up.
Yeah.
Some of the twinkliness gets a little bit cartoony in places, but broadly it holds up. Yeah. It looks good.
I think it's that key thing, which is mixing special effects and visual effects really expertly, knowing which one you're best to use at a given time. And this is something that, you know, in my day job, sort of on the Empire podcast, we talk about quite a lot. It's not that there is, you know, quote unquote, too much CGI. It's not that there's quote unquote ropey special effects. It's that you've just got to get the balance between the two spot on. And, you know, it's something that, I don't know, Barbie does well. And it's something that I think actually this does really, really well, especially in those flying scenes. The guy who did the visual effects, Roy Field, is an Oscar winner. He won for Superman. So, like, he was at kind of, again, they got a great team behind the scenes to put this together.
So how many Oscar winners are in this film, involved in this film? Because Mancini won an Oscar.
Yeah.
You've got the effects guy won an Oscar. Has Liv Garver won an Oscar? Has he even been nominated?
Dudley Moore.
Dudley Moore, did Dudley Moore win for Oscar? Did Arthur win for Arthur? Like, there's an awful lot of...
He was nominated. Like, he didn't win, I think.
There's a lot of... I'm sure John Lithgow has been nominated.
Mm. Oh, he's definitely been nominated, for sure.
Like, there's an awful lot of, like, high-grade talent in this film, which, yeah, let's be honest, is a very silly film.
It's kind of silly. But then, I mean, look, every kids movie, every Christmas movie to some degree is a little bit silly. What's striking to me is how people have been a little bit down on this over the years. John Lithgow was quoted as basically saying it's terrible and I don't understand why everyone in England loves it.
I once interviewed John Lithgow and I couldn't not ask him. I couldn't not... It was in December as well, and I just couldn't not ask him about Santa Claus. This was when he was filming The Crown. He was still filming the first season of The Crown. He came into The Guardian when I worked there, and I couldn't not ask the question. And he said, I think his exact words were, "piece of crap." It's a piece of crap. And it's like, you know, the tagline for it was "most expensive movie ever made." I don't believe that was the tagline.
No.
But it was, you know, I watched it and it's a piece of crap. And I was like, that's a little unfair because it is a beautifully made film in a lot of places. I actually think Lithgow's great in it as well.
He is a very memorable villain, or he was to me as a child. You know, I really remembered that sort of snarling capitalist oligarch demon character. I love actually rewatching it today. I was really struck by a moment that never really struck me as a kid, which is when he says, "Well, you know, why would I want to be like Santa? He never did anything for me." And Patch says, "Oh, you must have been a naughty boy then," which is a line that it's very hard to say with a straight face. And Lithgow goes, "Yes, I was." And he just has this little grin on his face, like he's remembering all his childhood's villainy, frankly.
But
it's a beautifully played little moment.
Yeah, and there's there's loads of good bits in that. There's a bit in that where he walks into his office and he's wearing a buttonhole. He's wearing a rose in his button. And I've never noticed it until this morning. He takes the rose out and then he just pulls it to pieces before he sits down for no reason. He just destroys a flower for no reason. And then he sits down, lights a cigar and puts his spats on his desk. And it's amazing. And there's a bit when he's walking up a staircase, cracking his knuckles. And then he says, "I love the sound of cracking knuckles." That's how villainous he is. He loves the sound of his knuckles cracking. I can't think of anything more horrible when you're a child of that sort of thing. He's such a grotesque. Also, for reasons that I still am not sure of the financial benefit of, he stuffs his teddy bears with nails and glass. I can understand the flammable doll. Mm. I can understand the flammable doll.
Like, I can forgive the flammable... No, wait.
he's cutting costs by using a flammable material and it goes up in flames. And we all saw that on Watchdog in the 80s with the Scottish lady. But then they go, "And this is advertised for 3-year-olds. And they pull the head off a teddy bear, turn it upside down, and nails and broken glass fall out. And I do not understand why he's using building material to stuff teddy bears. I don't know the financial benefit. I don't know, like, what corners he was trying to cut by doing it. I'm just glad he was caught.
I did have the same thought today watching it. I'm like, I'm not sure those are, like, if he'd been putting sawdust in the teddy bears, which would still be unpleasant for kids, you know, hugging a teddy, I get. And you might have some accidental nails in there, I suppose, if they had fallen off in the floor of the carpentry shop where apparently you get your materials. I guess that would make a certain amount of sense. But yes, nails, broken glass and assorted, looked like razor blades, you know, does seem non-economical. Maybe that's why his company is in trouble, apart from the, you know, regulation. I'm also not sure that you have to be licensed to sell toys in the US, but maybe you did in the 80s, and that's something that the Republicans have removed since.
Your toy making license has been revoked for not being jolly enough.
I think that's a line from a Terry Pratchett book, pretty much, isn't it?
Witches Abroad.
Yeah.
The toy maker was dragged away for not being jolly and handing out sweets to children.
Yes. But just to lift the curtain a little bit, Mark and I really bonded over our shared fandom of Terry Pratchett, and I actually wrote the introduction for his fantastic, fantastic biography of Pratchett, which if people haven't read, you should pick up and read. That's still available everywhere, right?
It's still available in all of the normal book buying places.
Excellent.
Not usually in shops, but certainly online.
But certainly online. It's a very
every once in a while I find it in a shop and it makes me really happy. But yes, it's I'm very pleased with that. And Helen's forward for it is absolutely wonderful. In fact, you compare Terry to Santa in the forward.
Well, I do. And let us take a momentary tangent here and talk about Terry Pratchett, because we like to do that. But yes, because he, you know, wore a distinctive hat, had a distinctive beard, and brought goodies at least once a year, and in Terry's case, sometimes more than that. But they tended to come out in sort of, you know, October, November time. It was terribly handy for me when I was going Christmas present shopping for literally anyone in my family. But yeah, you know, there is a parallel there. He's maybe not quite as commendably jolly as a person, as your book discusses a little bit. But also, you know, his characters, his world brings at least as much joy as any of the wooden toys in this film.
I'm Sam Clements, host of the 90 Minutes or Less Film Festival, another podcast in the Stripped Media family, a podcast that celebrates movies under 90 minutes long. Each episode, I'm joined by a special guest who selects a movie to join our prestigious lineup. Past guests have included fellow Stripped Media family members Martin and Sam from Song by Song, and Kobe from Flixwatcher, and Dave from The Wire Stripped. Search for us now on the app you're currently listening to this podcast, or join us at 90minfilmfest.com.
Actually, this film does a version of, because there's two kind of on-screen Santas, aren't there? You either get your purest Santa, which is what Huddleston's doing. He's your jolly old Saint Nick, and he's great at it, and he sells it completely. Like, he even sells ho ho ho. Like, he even, it's like, and he, what, you believe that this guy's laughing, like, and he's out of exhilaration and happiness. Like, he really sells it. Also, one of my other favorite moments in this, this really struck me today, was when they read out "'Twas the Night Before Christmas" to him. And stop, read that bit again. He had a little round belly that shook when he laughed.
Like a bowl full of jelly.
Yeah. And then Mrs. Claus going, well, the cookies. It's a really great scene, and they do it beautifully. So you've got real Santa, but then you've also got what actually I think is closer to what we're talking about of who Terry Pratchett was, which is the versions of Santa films that do the cynical Santa, like the grumpy Santa, like Violent Night last year, which was I'm determined to. Is going to be a perennial for me. I'm going to watch it every single year, because I had more fun with that film than I've had with something in the cinema for a long time. But I like the idea that you have these films where Santa, and Elf does it as well. Santa is crotchety and grumpy and a bit weird and slightly unpleasant sometimes. I kind of feel like that's sort of how Terry would have been a Santa, a bit like the one on the street in Home Alone.
Right. Yes.
Right. Hey, every kid who sees Santa gets something. Have some Tic Tacs. Like, yeah, I think the Terry Pratchett Santa comparison works quite nicely. He also, of course, wrote a brilliant Christmas story.
He did, The Hogfather, yeah.
Which, I return to every single year. One of the two audiobooks I really enjoy every year. I always listen to Hogfather, and I always listen to Tom Baker reading A Christmas Carol, which, if you've never listened to, is amazing.
Ooh, I haven't heard that. Ooh. It's
really good. An unabridged version, a really good special, really good set, like sound mix, lots of different stuff happening, and Tom Baker is perfect. If I start on Christmas carols, we will never get off this course.
Well, we did a special episode on that at the end of last year, because we had both Spirited and Scrooge, A Christmas Carol, come out in the same year. So we sort of did a Christmas Carol focused episode. If people haven't heard that, do please go back and have a look.
Which can actually bring us neatly back to this, because is it Leslie Bracusi? Is that how you, is that how you say it? Brycuse,
I think, isn't it?
Brycuse, how you say his name. He actually wrote the songs in the musical version of Scrooge.
Yes, he did. Yes.
Which came out last year, well, and also in 1970, which was, you know, the songs are good. I really like, it's got a bit where they dance Scrooge's coffin through the streets, singing as they go, which is one of the best moments in that incredibly mad film. And there's also, I'm pretty sure that song's the inspiration for Good Afternoon in Spirited, just to tie all of those themes with a little bow. Anyway,
I feel that way. So, okay, so let's kind of wrap this up with a couple of things we haven't talked about yet. On Lithgow, on the bad guy, does it feel like there maybe isn't enough of him? Like there maybe should have been just a little bit more. He should have been a little bit more present in the story.
Well, he doesn't turn up until, what, the halfway point?
Yeah, almost, yeah.
Because I've always thought this was two halves, this film, very much. It's not three acts, it's two halves, in that you've got the twinkly stuff at the beginning and then you've got the New York stuff at the end. And he doesn't turn up until that present day storyline. And he's a brilliant cigar chomping, practicing for Churchill probably, cigar chomping performance. But yeah, there's not much to it. Like, it's very one note. He doesn't play the layers, does he? Apart from that little moment you identified of the being a naughty boy, which is lovely. It's really, really lovely. But yeah, you're right. There isn't enough of him. We don't really care about his motivation. I don't think him and Santa are on screen at the same time at any point.
No, I don't think they meet. No.
Which is an odd decision to have your main hero and your main baddie never actually like cross paths. I'm not sure if Santa even knows who he is.
I don't think he really... He seems to disapprove of the endeavour. He sees the TV ad, but then patches in that rather than BZ, I suppose. So, yeah, he disapproves, but I don't know that he's particularly engaged with him as a person, is he?
In fact, from Santa's point of view, Patch goes off, and they're a bit sad and worried about Patch. And then he sees that Patch has been on telly and has made lollies, and he sees some of those lollies under the tree, and then he goes, oh, that's weird, okay. But carries on delivering his presents, and then he finishes his run for the day, and then he goes home. And then he gets a letter from the definitely charming and not at all creepy and weird little girl, Cordelia, who says, Joe's been kidnapped, we've got to go and rescue him. And then he flies out, sees Dudley Moore in an exploding car, does a loop-the-loop for no reason and catches him. Like, the whole BZ storyline is completely separate from that. Like, he never knows about him. He never actually cares who he is, which is, an odd narrative decision. It's an odd film because narratively, the first half is so well structured and so well crafted, and they've got an answer to everything. This is why Santa can fly. This is why he lives forever. This is where the toys come from. This is why he wears red, like, because he doesn't look good in green, even though he then subsequently wears a lot of green. Which slightly annoys me, but you know, all of those things, this is why naughty and nice comes from, all of those things are explained and they're given real, like, proper dramatic reasoning and proper thought through. And then the second half doesn't feel like anything is thought through at all, nothing at all. And yeah, the lack of any real motivation for John Lithgow's character or any real, like, development for him or any of his friends, although I did always quite like Towser. I always thought, and his fondness for Puce. There is a bit where he turns to him and goes, "I've always wondered about you," which is actually at the beginning of the new Blu-ray. It says this film contains some views that modern audiences might find it unpalatable or something, and that's the only moment I could think of.
I think that must be what they meant, because it does sound just a little bit homophobic. Like it's, yeah, just but it's very light. I don't feel like a kid watching it is going to pick up on that. I wouldn't be particularly worried about that personally, but of course I'm not the person affected, so but yes, it doesn't, it's not the most egregious one of these films.
Yeah, and it's nowhere near as offensive as the rampant capitalism. That's way more offensive, because the other image I've always taken from this film, the thing I remembered from being a very little boy, was always, first of all, the magicalness at the start and the elves and the twinkliness and all the twinkly wee stuff, And then secondly, the little homeless boy with his face pressed up against, with his nose pressed up against the window of McDonald's, and all the people, like, it's almost like McDonald's porn. Mm. Like, they're just really, really enjoying themselves eating their McDonald's, lovingly lensed, and you come out of it wanting McDonald's. And then later on, when he drinks Coke, he has a gulp of a can of Coke, and then sort of smacks his lips and goes, ah, and sits back contentedly. And it's, you know, it's not subtle, is it? It really isn't.
The product placement could have been perhaps just a little bit less blatant, for sure. And I mean, God bless the two child actors. Neither of them has really gone on to an adult career. Carrie Cahelm as Cornelia and Christian Fitzpatrick as Joe. They both made a couple of other things around this time. I think she was in an episode of The Equalizer. He was in Vice Versa, I think, in a supporting role, if I remember correctly, but I don't really remember. The Tom Hanks body swap. Was Tom Hanks not...
No, it wasn't
Judge,
Tom
Hanks. Judge it was, Reinhold body
yeah,
swap.
It was the other body swap film that came out.
Body
it was
swap.
It's one of those deep impact Armageddon things,
yes.
When there was now you mention it, I do remember him in that.
Mm.
I haven't seen it for a long time, but he was like the wisecracking best friend.
Yes, that makes sense.
He like has to teach Judge Reinhold to shave. No, that can't be right. Anyway, there's definitely shaving in it. I haven't seen it since like 1989. Leave me alone. No, you're right. They do a good job. They do their jobs on screen. They are absolutely fine.
I remember definitely wanting to be her when I was young watching it. I was like, wow, can you imagine if you were her and Santa came down the chimney and you got to chat with him? That would be cool. I did have a question today, though. I was watching her play with her tiny toy piano. And I was thinking, well, first of all, she's way too old for that and I don't buy it. Second of all, are you telling me there isn't a grand piano in that house?
There's a Steinway somewhere
there's
in that
Steinway
house.
There's a Steinway somewhere, damn it.
There's like classical art in there. Like those teddy bears stuffed with sawdust and glass have like those have bought some ill-gotten gains, and there's definitely a good piano in there somewhere.
I really had questions about Cordelia after today, because I mean she says to poor little orphan boy, is it Joe? Yeah, she says to poor Joe, oh, there's a room in the basement that nobody ever goes into, and then she puts him in the dankest looking cellar I have ever seen in my life. I was expecting it to be like a, I don't know, like a little room next to the boiler that maybe has, you know, like a den, you know, like you would see in a sort of middle class American house with a pull out couch. I was thinking worst case scenario that, because I'd forgotten that scene. And then she's literally putting him in a dank cellar.
How many rooms has that house got as well? It's a huge
right?
house. And there appears, and in fact, BZ even says at one point, like, who's in the house? Oh, just my niece and her nanny, right? So there are definitely spare bedrooms. There's definitely spare rooms. And he's not well.
He's not well.
The reason she brings him in is he's running a fever. She puts him in the basement, where he then isn't tied up. I misremembered it. I thought that was where they tie him up and leave him, but they don't. They take him away to a different basement and tie him up there. But yeah, that doesn't work. She also calls him little boy at one point, and I always thought that's quite patronising.
Little patronising,
like,
yeah.
Like, little boy, where are you? Like, no.
So the film ends with them both staying at the North Pole. Amazing. Again, wish fulfillment fantasy for all the kids in the audience. Sounds incredible. Screw you, Mum and Dad. I'm off to live at the North Pole with Santa and Mrs. Claus, who is my age. But I did have questions. Like, she's presumably now the heir to a fair fortune, even after the lawyers have been at it all. And she's just going to vanish for a year. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what happens there legally. I mean, I assume she wouldn't be able to inherit just yet, or that it would be put in a trust fund. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I feel like he's the kind of guy who would have not bothered about that, but presumably would have had somebody take care of it all for him. But the thing is, yeah, like, she is effectively an orphan. She doesn't have parents, and her legal guardian has just floated off into space. So I don't know. It'll be a while before anybody misses her. Like, the nanny didn't seem particularly attentive. That's a great... she's too busy watching... what's it she watched? There's a line I'm off to watch. Is it the actor? Is it like...
Oh, it's her stories, isn't it? What was it?
No, it's like mystery... It's something
Mystery
theatre.
It's mystery theatre.
Yeah, it's like, which is a nice little character moment. There's a lot of nice little character moments in this film.
The bit where the nanny eats the magic lollipop, which of course Cordelia, being too pure and on the side of the angels, isn't interested in the magic lollipop that has mysteriously appeared under her tree because it doesn't come from Santa, therefore it isn't good enough for her because she's a princess. So the nanny eats it and floats into the air and says, "I feel like Mary Poppins." And I'm like, oh, is that all you can reach for? Can you not imagine being Superman? You know, aim higher, woman. Aim higher.
Supergirl came out last year.
Come on, woman.
Presumably the Superman films didn't exist in that universe.
No,
because or maybe they're a shared universe and Superman was real. No, she'd have, because then she'd definitely have reached for Superman. She could have done better anyway. Although, also, I mean, I have questions about the safety of just letting people float, and how it easily is accepted, can they fly properly? How high can they go? What happens when it runs out? Do they just fall out of the sky? Do they have those powers forever? I don't know.
It does seem like some serious product liability testing was not done. And yes, frankly, I foresee a field day for the lawyers.
Which means that they missed out on the very obvious elf and safety department joke.
Oh.
Considering they do an elf joke for everything else, like elf aware, I've got some elf awareness, elf, like all that stuff. There's not an elf pun that they leave unmined apart from that one.
It's a missed opportunity. That alone would have added 50 million to the box office. Speaking of your elf, I have a couple of questions I ask everybody on this podcast. So first of all, what is your favourite Christmas film? Now, obviously you watch this every year, but does that mean it's your favourite?
I mean, I think it does. I think it does. It's the one it's this or the Muppets Christmas Carol, isn't it? I mean, these are root one answers. These are not like deep cut answers. And I like Christmas films. I've watched a lot of Christmas films every year. I have to ration them out. I have to be really careful about when I start watching Christmas films and listening to Christmas music. Like, can't do it in November. I will blow my load too quickly. I'll get bored. It has to be concentrated. I stagger things up. I start with kind of sort of Christmas adjacent films, and then I gradually make it more Christmassy as I go along until I get to the big hitters. And Santa Claus the Movie cannot be watched until Christmas Eve. It has to be Christmas Eve. And Muppets is Christmas Eve as well. So yeah, I'm trying to think of an out there one, but I can't, because it's definitely
they're almost all either bad or very popular. There is a very slim space between bad and very popular for Christmas movies. There's a couple that you can argue, but otherwise,
I think Violent Night is actually going to get in there as for me, because I'm really looking forward to seeing it again, because it's so splattery and silly, and it manages to be like warm and Christmassy and violent and horrible at the same time, and nostalgic, and I like that's really difficult to pull off. So I'm looking forward to that might become one. I don't know. There's hipster answers to that question as well, isn't there? Like if you're a Christmas hipster, then you're going to go, oh no, I like the 1934 Miracle on 34th Street, not the 1994 Miracle on 34th Street. Sorry.
David Attenborough. Well, Richard Attenborough. Come on.
Yeah, is Dickie Attenborough enough in for me? But yeah, so yes, my predictable answer is The Muppets Christmas Carol, because I think it's pretty much perfect. And I say this as somebody who has watched every single version of A Christmas Carol that's available.
Yeah.
And I mean that not just like I'm pretty comfortable in saying I've watched every single one that is easily available, because that's my favourite story. It's my favourite piece of art in the world, A Christmas Carol, and I have watched all of them, and I think The Muppets Christmas Carol surpasses any other version.
It's a remarkably faithful adaptation.
Not a controversial opinion again, although the guy from the Dickens Society you had on that podcast you mentioned earlier, because I went and listened to that one today, and I was appalled that he hadn't seen The Muppets Christmas Carol.
I
hope he's put it right.
I really hope he has. I really did recommend it to him, so I very much hope that he has. But anyway, my other question I ask everybody at this point is, do you have any Christmas traditions that are unusual or different? Is there a particular food you have to eat? Is there a particular time you have to open your presents? Well, how do you do it?
There is no weird traditions in my family. None of them are weird. Like, it's incredible. In fact, I've always found it odd. Because I've always found it odd when people do things differently. Because we were always very, very like you know, you open your presents in the morning, you do a stocking, then you go downstairs and there's bigger presents, and then you play with them, and then there's a dinner, and then there's a film, and then there's sleepiness, and that's basically still how I do it. And then I remember getting a very middle class girlfriend once, and going to Christmas at her parents, and suddenly it was, oh, church. No presents till after dinner. What is this bullshit? And being completely broadsided by it. But we don't have. Not honestly. It's very boring. It's not boring. It's lovely. But there are no like weird. My partner Melanie, who is a historian. Her Christmas tradition is she watches Downfall on Christmas Eve.
Wow.
Like,
okay.
Every year. So every year she watches Downfall on Christmas Eve and Fury, the tank-based film with Brad Pitt, on Christmas Day. Those are her Christmas traditions.
Am I right in thinking that that's not her primary era of study either?
No, she's a French Revolution expert.
Yeah.
But and her secondary era of study is like late Victoriana, Jack the Ripper. She's mostly into royalty, but she really, really likes Downfall.
Nothing says Christmas like Hitler learning he's done for. So I guess there's something warming and cheering about that for all of us.
Just before he drifts off into space.
Exactly. Wouldn't it be nice? Just before you go, we have to talk about your comedy tour I think you're doing in 2024. I've seen sort of the magic of Terry Pratchett now in London, but you're taking it on the tour around the country, I believe, in the next few months.
Yes, so I wrote a one-man show based on my book about Terry Pratchett. It's sort of a celebration of everything he was and everything he believed. And I'm very proud of it, actually.
It's very funny.
Thank you. And Helen was good enough to interview me in the second half of the show when we did it in London. We're taking it on tour. It starts in Belfast in January, I believe, and then sort of February, March, April, I'm gigging here, there and everywhere. If you go to my website, it's markburrows.co.uk /live-events if you want the full thing, but you can navigate to it. But yeah, it's called The Magic of Terry Pratchett. We are all over the place. Goes up to Scotland, down to Cornwall, up to the Midlands, like, you know, pretty much everywhere. Still adding dates to it, and I'm really excited about doing that because it's yeah, it's an awful lot of fun, and it's a story that means a lot to me, and I really like telling Terry's story on stage. So yeah, please do come. That would be wonderful.
I should say it's a fantastic evening for Pratchett fans. It's also a genuinely, I think, fun evening for people who are not yet Pratchett fans. I don't believe there's any other group than those two groups. There's the Pratchett fans and the people who are not yet Pratchett fans.
I fundamentally believe that. Yeah,
yes.
And I tried to write it so it's accessible. It's meant to be written. I tried to write something that, you know, you don't have to be a super fan. I actually had a lot of people at the Edinburgh Fringe coming up to me, like literally saying, I've never read a Terry Pratchett book. I came along with my wife, but that was wonderful. I'm going to go and read one now. That's when you go, oh yeah, okay, that's what I wanted. That's exactly what I wanted to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And have you got some new books coming up as well? How is that coming along?
I'm writing a book about Nirvana at the moment, which should be out early next year, which is a kind of just it's heavily footnoted. I was going to call it The Annotated Nirvana, but my publisher said no. But it's basically a kind of very factual timeline of the group Nirvana, of what happened to them in order, in quite a lot of detail, and then the footnotes, which are half the book. Like, the footnote word count is actually slightly higher than the main book word count.
Amazing.
So it goes into detail. So I mention something, and then I'll go into detail in the footnote about what that is and how. So it's you've got the story, then you've got the context of the story underneath it. So that's the thing I'm working on at the minute. And then I'm writing another book about David Bowie and Mark Bolan, which is a sort of sequel to the one I wrote about them in the 60s, called The London Boys, that came out last year.
Fantastic. Well, you are busy. very, very busy, so I will let you get back to it. But thank you so much for joining us to talk Santa Claus the Movie. As I say, it's now out in 4K. Impressions? I mean, my impression was it's just clearer and better and you can see more of it. How did you feel about that?
Looks good. Looks lovely. I mean, I'm not one to start going on about the eye-popping reds and the inky blacks and stuff, but it looked and sounded great to me.
Yeah.
So I haven't seen the 4K presentation. I've just seen the standard Blu-ray presentation, but it did look lovely.
Yeah, it really did. And thank you very much to Mark Burrows again for joining me, and we'll be back soon with another Christmas movie for your delectation. They're coming thick and fast this year. So thanks everybody for joining us, and Merry Christmas, Mark.
Merry Christmas.
Well, that's it for this episode of Bah Humbug. Please join us next time for more Christmas movies madness. In the meantime, I've been your host, Helen O'Hara. This podcast is edited by Ben Williams and produced by Kobe Omanaka for Stripped Media. And if you've enjoyed the pod, please do rate us with 5 shiny Christmas stars wherever you listen to your podcasts. But whatever you do, happy holidays!
Just heard a Stripped Media production.